Okay, let's get started. I sent a mail to the class with the third project, the part three. Project part three is out. Due December 1st. And as I said in the mail, basically starting from 1st, right around that time, you will all have like a short, like a 15-minute slot with the TA where you demonstrate your system in the lab, I guess, somewhere. Okay, so those details will come when we come close to that. And I don't think there is anything specifically to talk about part three. It has one required part is a clustering part, k-means clustering and the search results. And then there's a bunch of suggestions on the second task that you can do. But you can also do something other than the list of tasks that we gave. So you can pick something different from what. But if you're doing that, it would be good for you to let us know, just so that we know what to expect. Okay. So that's regarding part three. I have these things. Just remind me and take it before you leave. I brought it last week and I forgot. This is the homework part two of part homework two, I guess, which is the anatomy of Google thing. So it's been graded. Okay. Any questions? So the agenda today is complete the discussion of recommendation systems, in particular the collaborative filtering that we started talking about last time, and then actually go into search advertising, which is also, advertisements are also recommendations, right? Because they're recommending stuff to you, and in doing so, they get paid by somebody else, okay? So in fact, advertisements are a kind of sponsored recommendations, whereas normal recommendations are Amazon is recommending it to you so that maybe you'll buy more stuff from them, okay, or just to make you happy. So the interesting thing when you get to search advertising is there are more parties. Here essentially it's the search engine and you, that's it. You know, when you're recommending, it's either the search engine or the company which is doing the recommendation to you, and you yourself, whether you like the recommendation or not. Okay, when you get to advertising, there are three parties. There is the user, there is the thing that is doing the recommendations of the advertisement, which is search engine, and then the people who want their advertisements to be placed, which are the advertisers. And so it's a more interesting problem. We'll look at that a little also. Obviously, you all know, search advertisement is the reason why most search engine companies are actually alive right now. Most of internet is alive because of advertisement. So we'll look at that too. Okay, so that's basically the agenda. Any questions on collaborative filtering? Okay, so the one thing that I was mentioning at the end of last class was that between content-based filtering and collaborative filtering, content-based filtering is domain sensitive. That means it actually needs to know what it is that it is recommending. And collaborative filtering is domain free because it doesn't know what it is recommending. The only reason it's recommending them to you is because people like you who bought various other things, so that's why they're like you. These are the ones that they also bought. So they bought this other item and maybe you will be interested in it. Okay? In some sense, it's the items are connected only because of correlation between the users who are buying them. And this is exactly what we did in finding association clusters for the words. When we found that computer is connected to science, it's not really the case that computer is equal to science. It's just that every document which had computer also happened to have science. Okay, so here basically in collaborative filtering, you can think of users as the documents and items as the words. And everything you know about co-occurrence analysis can be done here again. Okay, so I just get to do it again once more. The only minor change is you are aware of the fact, unlike in documents, so basically the big analogy here in collaborative filtering is documents, users, words, items. That's the analogy, right? So you can do dot dot similarity matrix, word similarity matrix, and then from that you can compute which words are more similar to other words. You can also compute which documents are more similar to other documents. This is all stuff we have done. So you can do that here too, which users are more similar to other users in terms of their buying patterns, which items are more similar to other items in the sense that people who buy these items are also buying these other items. Okay. The only interesting thing, so pretty much we will just transfer our insights from here to here and call it collaborative filtering. The only difference really is when you're thinking about documents can have large numbers of words, you know, whereas users typically may not be buying enough items. Okay, and so because of which there may not be enough co-occurrence information that you may be able to derive. If in fact it turns out most users are not buying enough items, they are not good enough consumers, then essentially if they haven't bought or if they have not rated that item, essentially, then that item is not part of the user bag. So if the word is not part of the document, that means the document doesn't like the word. That's clear. If an item is not part of the items that the user has rated, that doesn't mean that the user doesn't like the item. It only means the user hasn't yet bought that item. So that's the distinction. And so we will actually deal with that with a few variations on the association cluster idea. Okay, so let's go to association clusters applied to items and users. So just as you had document term matrix, you can start with an item user matrix, okay? And then you can do your association clusters and scalar clusters and everything, okay? So if you think of, you can either think of users as the vectors in the space of items, or think of items as vectors in the space of users, okay? If you do either then you can actually do vector similarity between users or vector similarity between items. Okay, in fact, that's pretty much what we will do. The only difference we'll do is we'll actually talk of something called Pearson correlation coefficient, which turns out to be vector similarity on the ratings vector, except they take the ratings vector and center it. So the idea is if I have rated something between 1 to 10, okay, and my ratings are, so here are my items that I have, I1, I2, etc., I7, and then I rated it 2, this is 4, this is 9, this is 5, let's say. That's the ratings vector. Okay, what is actually more interesting to me is not what the rating that the user gave, but really what's the mean of the user's rating, and what is the difference of each of the items from their average. So because some users are easy to please. They think everything is great. So they give it more like 9 all the time. Okay? Some people are really, really hard to please. They'll only give up to 3 in the rating. So if somebody gives a 3, so you know, in and who never gives more than 3, then that's like an A+. Like in this class. I mean, if you get like, you know, 50% on the exam, it could be an A+. Right? So what matters is how far are you from the average? Okay? So you center the vector by essentially taking the mu, which is the average of the ratings, and then essentially taking 2 minus mu, 4 minus mu, 9 minus mu, 5 minus mu. That's your centered ratings vector. Now if you take vector similarity between the centered rating vectors, that actually can be also seen as what is called Pearson correlation coefficient. We'll see that in a minute. Okay, it turns out that the vector similarity between centered rating vectors can be interpreted in terms of variance and covariance over vectors, over ratings. Okay, so people basically think of the distance, the similarity measure they say they're using is the Pearson correlation coefficient, which is just vector similarity on centered vectors, centered rating vectors. Okay, and then you can do that. Once I have a similarity metric, I can compute the similarity between users. I can also compute similarity between items. I mean, I can also do item-item clusters. Okay, so in the beginning, the traditional idea for collaborative filtering is to actually figure out who your neighbors are. That's the picture that I showed you here. You know, here is the current user, and you figure out who their, you know, close soulmates are in terms of how similar they are to this user. And then you want to see how are they rating this particular item C. And then you want to predict this guy's rating for C as a weighted average of his or her most similar neighbor's rating for C. That's the simple idea of collaborative filtering. Okay, actually it's not a simple, that's the first idea of collaborative filtering. That's what I will describe. Okay, but there is a much simpler idea where you can ignore who your neighbors are and you can just compute item-item correlation matrix. And then I don't need to know about the users. If you remember term-term correlation matrix and you find the association clusters for the terms, then I don't need to know who are the documents, where did I get this number from. In fact, it will be I by I matrix. Right? And then so if this guy has a few of these items, given each of these items, I can see what other items they are close to and then just suggest to them. That's a different way of doing collaborative filtering. That's called item-centered collaborative filtering. Okay? So the first idea, of course, is user-centered collaborative filtering, where you weight all the users with respect to their similarity to the active user, the user that for whom you're trying to do the recommendation. And as I said, you will measure similarity essentially as a variance of vector similarity, okay, over rated, centered vectors. And then of these users, then you select a subset of these users as saying these are your k nearest neighbors, okay? And then you want to consider your rating for the missing items. I want to predict as their rating for a particular missing item. That is the item for which the active user doesn't have a rating yet. And so you want to see whether they like it. Okay? So you will predict that item's rating as a weighted sum of the ratings of the individual, of its neighbor, of his neighbors. Okay, I'll give you the details in a minute. Okay? And then having done this, then you have computed the ratings for all the items that the user doesn't already own. Okay, and then among them, see which ones have high enough ratings and say you may be interested in buying these. So I show that to you. That's what is collaborative filtering. Okay, so the idea of Pearson correlation coefficient essentially is given the ratings vectors, the covariance of the rating vector of, let's say, active user A. So each user is in, you know, represented in terms of their ratings over the items, right? So in the document's case, each document is represented in terms of the frequency of each of the terms in that document. Similarly here, it's the frequency for the items, you're talking about the ratings for the items. Okay. So Pearson correlation coefficient is nothing but covariance of the two vectors, two rating vectors RA and RU, divided by the variance of the variance of RA, standard deviation of RA and standard deviation of RU. Okay, now what are those? So standard deviation, so again, you know, covariance is you take the vector of RAI, RA, and then you center it. The way you center it is you subtract from each of the ratings the average rating of A. Okay, and similarly for U, you subtract average rating of U. Okay, and then you multiply those two and you sum over all the pairs, all the corresponding pairs. Yeah. That's what this is basically vector similarity over centered vectors. It's just it's called Pearson correlation coefficient. You know, it comes from a different level area, but it's the same idea. It's again a dot product. Okay, so that's covariance, and then the variance. So the standard deviations essentially are, you know, are basically just a square. So covariance between a vector and itself is the standard, and the square root of that is the standard deviation. Okay, so that's what they're saying here. Okay, and if I do this, then I can compute this measure, the correlation coefficient between A and U, as the covariance of RARU divided by this. Now notice that you can only compute the covariance over the items that are common between both of them. So the average rating for each user is the average over all of their ratings. But the numbers that actually come here were only for those ones which both of them have rated together. Because if one of them rated and the other didn't rate, then how am I going to get this number at all? Okay, so it's a biased estimate. It's estimating similarity only over the items that both of them have rated. And that is something you want to keep in mind. Okay, in a document, if there's no word, that means the word is not liked. In item vector, you know, if there is no item, if an item has no rating, that doesn't mean that I don't like the item. In fact, I just don't know about that item. Okay, so you are forced to essentially consider only, this computation is done only over the vectors that are rated. Only the items that are rated. Yes. No, I mean, the average for each user, you do take their average over all their ratings. So suppose I rated 10 items, you rated 20 items. Together, we only have 3 items in common. So this product is going to be only over 3 items. But the averages are my average over my 10 items and your average over your 20 items. That tells you more about, you know, whether you are a easy to please or hard to please person. Okay, so that's the idea. Okay, and this is just saying that Pearson correlation coefficient is nothing but vector similarity over centered vectors. Okay, and covariance is dot product, and the square root of variance of each vector is nothing but norm of each vector. So you're actually computing exactly the vector similarity, you know, over these centered vectors. Okay, now, after doing this, you have computed the similarities between the current user and all the users in the database, in the customer database, and you need to pick some K users, top K users that are closest to this user. Okay, and then you'll pick the K users, and then the question, of course, is how do I then compute the rating for the ith item, predicted rating for the ith item for the active user? Presumably, that's because ith item has not yet been rated by this active user. I mean, you can compute what should have been your rating, and then, of course, tell you that you made a mistake in buying this item, you should return it, because you are not supposed to like this item. Right? I mean, that also can be done. Okay? But we will not, since I'm only interested in selling stuff, I'm not interested in changing your home, I'm only going to tell you, you know, the items that you haven't yet bought, whether you should buy them. Okay? So, what do I do? How do I do that? Again, in this case too, I will assume that the item that you haven't yet seen, you the active user haven't yet seen, you're likely to give it the average rating. If I don't know anything else, you will give your average rating. If you're an easy to please person, you're likely to give something 7 plus. Hard to please person, something 0 plus. Okay? And then the question is, what is the plus? Plus can be, you know, positive or negative too, actually. Right? And so I'm now computing the differential here. And all I'm doing in this case is the differential is being computed by, I'm taking your k close by neighbors. For each of the neighbors, I'm computing their differential for this item. Okay, so that means the user u has an average rating of r dash u. And they have given the specific rating to the ith item, RUI. So they gave this much as the differential. This could be positive or negative. They either liked it more than average or less than average among their positions. Okay? And then this user U is, you know, WAU close to you. This is their similarity to you. So you multiply this differential by this similarity, that's your weighted summation of the differentials divided by the similarity measures. Okay, that would give you essentially the average differential that you should add to RA. And you add that and you will get the predicted rating. Yes. Yes, yes. You're only considering the ones which have rated the item. You're only considering the users, you know, the neighbors which have rated the item. So in fact, if somebody did, then they are not going to take part in this computation. So this business of sparse ratings is a big issue in collaborative filtering. You notice that that was a problem in computing the similarity. It's also a problem in here. In fact, it's actually the next question that I'm going to ask is, so is this good enough? So this is basically the simple idea of user-centric collaborative filtering. Okay, yes.
What about when a new user has come into the system, logged into the system?
Then that's fine, you just do it. What, I don't know that.
But there's no average rating for that particular user, right? And there's no weight.
No, that's basically, you're talking about the cold start issue. That means if somebody doesn't have any ratings already, then you can't use collaborative filtering. That's a big problem in general for collaborative filtering. Okay, then I have to make assumptions that maybe you're an average user, so you will have an average rating of all the users, you know, average something. Otherwise, I can't say anything. Okay? And so collaborative filtering becomes more useful after people have put certain number of ratings. And also, it's a very interesting point, equivalently, that's related to you. If this is a completely new book, it hasn't yet been bought and rated by anybody, so nobody is going to have a rating. None of your K neighbors are going to have a rating for it. So you know no more than saying, I would just like this book, the average way I like books. If I'm a big, you know, bibliophile, I probably give something 6+. If I hate books, I start with 0+. Or 0-, right? So now the problem is, again, that's another cold start problem. That means if it's a new item, it hasn't actually been rated, you can't give other people any predictions on that. But content-based filtering doesn't have a problem. Because if you have liked books with these words in the past, then probably you will like this book, because this book also has these words in the title. Okay? One slight change improvement, this is kind of a useful thing to do in collaborative filtering, is you shouldn't just care about the similarity, you should care about similarity and the significance. The idea is that you might have rated, let's say, 20 items. You, the active user, have rated 20 items. Here is user 1 who has rated 100 items, okay, of which they only have in common with you 2 items. 2 items in common. Another U2 has rated maybe 200 items, okay, and they have in common with you, 17 items. Okay, now it may well be the case that this guy rated these 2 items that you rated along with him, you are like soulmates. And these 2 things, you're soulmates. You agreed completely. Because of which your similarity would be 1. Whereas this has 17 items, so they have a lot more experience, common shared experience with you, of items at least. And they may have rated it, and the question then is, should I care more about, and they may actually be less similar to you. And my favorite example for this, and you know, sometimes I ask about this, is the way, let's say, you might have had a long-suffering spouse. I don't know how many of you have, you know, wives and husbands. And, you know, at the time when you started going out with them, you probably, you know, like them or something. After a long time, you seem to agree on some things, disagree on some things, okay? And then at some point of time, you started having an affair with somebody else. I'm not against family values. You should follow family values. But if you did have an affair, what's likely to happen is the first few days of the heady affair, you're likely to agree on everything, right? Now, So there is this person, you know, long-suffering spouse, and there is this new flame, and there is a new movie in town. The spouse says, "I hated this movie." And the flame says, "I loved the movie." The question is, are you likely to like the movie or hate the movie? Okay? That's the question. And you know, obviously you think, obviously the new flame is likely to agree with you on everything, and just but your shared experience corresponds to two movies that you have seen till now. Okay? And you kind of like both of them, or at least you're too polite to disagree with each other, and you sort of suffered through both of them. Whereas the long-suffering spouse probably has a lot more experiences with you, and you have a better idea as to whether or not that similarity should mean more. Okay? So this is the long-suffering spouse clause, which is a significance is added, and so apart from the similarity that you compute, you multiply it by a significance factor. The significance factor basically would be 1.0 if you have enough experience, common experience together. It doesn't matter that you rated them the same way. If you have a long-suffering spouse who always disagrees with you, that's an extremely useful predictor. So if that person didn't like the movie, then you would love the movie. The problem is not that, you know, it's a question of just a prediction. We're not trying to take them to the movie. You just want to decide whether you want to see the movie. Okay? So the question then is, the significance weighting, you should sort of be dependent on the shared experience, the shared the total number of items that you have co-rated. You don't have to rate them exactly the same, it's just you co-rate it. And if it is less than some small number, then, so basically what I can do is, I might say, in this case I'm saying, the significance factor increases linearly from 0 up to 50. And then after 50, it just becomes equal to 1. So you've seen 50 movies with somebody, then presumably I think you have just enough as much experience, common experience with them as anybody else. So they should not, you know, they should not be penalized for not having enough common experience with you. Okay? So that's your significance factor. You multiply that. That sort of takes into account this problem. One of the problems that not every user has equal amount of common experience with every other user. Here, when I said common experience, I'm obviously stretching the word. You know, it's like you both separately experience the same book in your own rooms. You know, I'm not necessarily putting you in the same room and experiencing it together. Okay, but still, you co-rated the item. That's the question. Okay, so that's a useful addition to do, and that improves the collaborative filtering when it is user-centered. You can get rid of all these complications if you are doing item-centered collaborative filtering, because in that case, you just compute the correlation clusters for the items, the way you computed correlation clusters for the words in the midterm, right? And then for each item, you can then say, what are the k closest items for this item? And then I can then start suggesting those to you. Okay? So that one slight advantage of this over user-centered prediction is you can at least say that these items are just functional synonyms. They seem to co-occur together. And so that's why I'm recommending it to you. So you can explain your recommendation a little bit better than the previous case where you just say, there is this intermediate called users that I don't want to tell you about, but those users seem to be having the same habits as you are, and they have this item, so you should also have it. Okay. So collaborative filtering, by the way, is a forced way, the way Amazon forces people to keep up with Joneses. You know, you keep up with your neighbors, you know, where neighbors are computed in the similarity world. Okay? Yes?
So I think that the collab, more of this filtering looks more like your kind of stuff that is not.
What kind of stuff means what? The content based, you mean?
Yeah.
No, because in both cases, remember that. So the interesting thing is the item centered collaborative filtering, each item was a vector in the space of users. The user feature doesn't have any meaning. So if in fact, I can't tell you, so if I were to recommend to you this book using content based filtering, and you say, why did you recommend it to me? Then I will say, well, the words you know, the words economics and computer science seem to occur very much in the books you buy. And this book has economics of computer science in its title, so that's why I'm recommending it to you.
But you can use this as a judge for those if they are the same kind.
I don't know. They're what?
Suppose that these are books also, like those, same domain.
Mm-hmm.
You can use these as judges for the decisions you take there.
I still don't understand what you're saying. We should
yeah.
talk though. I mean, so basically in this case, you're still not doing anything domain specific. The items can well be that if you like this book, you would also like aspirin. Okay, where aspirin is not a book, it's just bought. You know, people who bought this book also bought aspirin. So I will put it together for you. Okay, it's just an association. It's not, there is no content-based understanding of the items. Okay? So that's the collaborative first filtering from the item-based direction. And then I asked you to look at the Netflix Prize paper. We talked about it last time. And one cute thing there is that actually the winning system, you know, mostly depended on. So in terms of the use of content-based and collaborative filtering, I think that paper, if you read that, you would know that Pandora, which is this music service, actually does content-based filtering. Okay, and to be able to do content-based filtering, they had humans who listened to different songs, and they have come up with a set of features for describing songs. Okay, hard tempo, you know, fast tempo, metallic, this, that, etc. And then for each song, they make it a vector in the space of these features. And then they suggest new features, because of that, since they only deal with songs, and they don't basically tell you anything else. They just talk to you about, they deal with songs, and they can essentially care about, if you actually say, in fact, the usual thing that Pandora, I mean, I don't know how many of you have used Pandora the service, you can pick a song and say, I want to make a station around this song. And so it just essentially computes all the songs of, you know, all the vectors that are close to this vector, and then just randomly starts playing those to you. So Pandora uses content-based filtering, and somebody is paid to come up with features, and a whole bunch of undergrad students have been paid to, you know, write the vector representation for each of the songs. Okay? Whereas for Netflix, you could have done that too, but actually the thing that was working better for Netflix turned out to be collaborative filtering. It's not obvious. I couldn't have said that is the case, but it seems to have worked better for Netflix. Okay, and so in fact the point that this particular paper was making is it was doing collaborative filtering, but first before doing collaborative filtering, they actually did LSI on the item user metrics. Okay, so that you come up with a factor space where users as well as items are dots, are points in this factor space. And remember the picture that we had where, you know, some things on statistics, some things on databases, and then when you did the factor space, then all the statistics ones kind of are closer to each other, all the database ones are closer to each other in a different direction. Okay, that's the kind of patterns you're hoping to find by doing LSI. And this picture, they're basically saying, they first factorized the matrix, and then this one is just a two factors. So they did reduce the dimensionality to two dimensions, where the dimensions are just some arbitrary linear combinations of the original dimensions. Okay, and then in that, if you now both the users and the movies would be vectors in this space. So I'm only showing movies because you don't know users. I mean, what if I tell you the user M7 lives here, user M9 lives here? You don't know who these people are. If it's you and your friend, then you might want to know where you are. But in particular, for the movies themselves, you know, this is sort of is a nice, interesting pattern that develops here. Okay, and so you take this particular representation and then do your collaborative filtering. So you start with reduced dimensionality and then do everything I said before, either item-centered or user-centered collaborative filtering, and that works well. And one technical point that they make, which I would not be able to go into too much detail here, is again to do LSI or to do basically any of these techniques on collaborative filtering, your problem is that there may be too many null values for the ratings. Most items probably haven't been rated by most people. Which actually then means that when you take two random pair of users, then the common rate items that they've rated is likely to be even smaller. Right? And so there is this problem that you are doing decisions based on small amounts of information. Okay, so how do they deal with this? There are two ways of dealing with this to make the LSI look better. So first of all, in the case of LSI, actually, it does matter that, you know, remember LSI is all about distances between points, right? And if in fact one point, you know, each user, let's say, you know, there are like 10,000 movies, each user, there are 10,000 movies, each movie is a vector in the space of a million users. Okay, now if I'm computing the distance between two items, you know, and if I'm ignoring all the dimensions that are not common between both of these, then I'm essentially computing distance between their projections rather than themselves. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if the true points are like this, let's say, I mean, the true points are like this, but one of these guys, in three dimensions, one of these guys didn't actually rate one of the dimensions. So then you will actually wind up getting projection right there. Both points would be right next to each other in the projection. And that distance is not the true distance in the actual high dimensional space. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay? And so it's actually a big issue in doing the LSI that these, you know, there are, you know, the some of the dimensions are not being considered originally. And so you need to get some numbers there. So either you have to somehow consider distances only on the dimensions which have common ratings, or impute or just predict what would have been the missing rating. And so the prediction part is actually what I'll be talking about next, but the way they could have done it essentially is for each user learn a content-based filter and use that content-based filter to fill up the missing ratings for the rest of the movies that they haven't yet seen. And so you have now a pseudo-vector which is full. Some of them are true ratings, some of them are predicted ratings based on content-based filtering. And then you do LSI. That's one idea. The other idea that they actually went with is they only compute the distance in terms of the reduced number of dimensions. But then if they do that, they are likely to wind up doing overfitting. So for example, they might wind up saying something like, you know, a particular feature is completely indicative of whether or not you will like this movie. And the feature could be U1700. That means the user 1700 liked that movie, because of which you will like the movie. Okay, that's overfitting. Okay, and to avoid that, they essentially basically regularize the learning and they say none of the weights can be larger than a certain value. And you know, that's sort of advanced, we can't actually go into this. It's a different way of doing SVD where you are allowing computation of distances over only the dimensions that they share, okay? But then you are also penalizing high weights for any particular dimension. And that's actually what they wound up using in the paper, okay? But the bigger challenge is both of these approaches are basically dealing with the same challenge, which is there are too many items that are not rated yet. Too many items that are not rated yet. Okay? And so you want to predict, in this case, either predict or live with the fact that they are not rated yet. Now, in terms of predicting, so actually I'm going to look at a more complete example of just predicting and then combining it with collaborative filtering here. So anyway, these are the problems with collaborative filtering. We talked about this cold start. There needs to be enough other users already in the system to find a match. If you're the first user in the system, they can't do collaborative filtering. Sparsity, if there are too many items to be recommended, most vectors are sparse. So most items are not rated, that means most pairs of users have very few commonly rated items, okay? First rater cannot recommend an item that has not yet been previously rated, even if there are lots and lots of people in the list. popularity bias cannot recommend items to somebody with very unique taste, because they don't have enough common ratings with anybody that works well for them. So if your k nearest neighbors, remember what collaborative filtering is doing, it's trying to find k nearest soulmates. Okay, these are the closest soulmates. What if the first soulmate to you has similarity 0.0000001? I will still use them, in because you asked me to just use k users, I'll just use the k users. But my prediction for you is not going to be particularly good, because I'm getting you pretty lousy soulmates. Okay, and so that's the problem. And so if you have non-popular taste, you are not likely to get much of a good recommendation. Okay, so that's basically some of the problems of collaborative filtering. If you look at it from that side, content-based filtering has lots of advantages, because it doesn't require data on other users, you know. It requires, but it only recommends to the users. I mean, it can also recommend to the users with unique tastes, and it can recommend new and unpopular items, and it can provide explanations for the items, saying the reason I'm, you know, giving this to you is because you like these words or these features before, okay. And of course, you know, the entire field of text categorization, our classification learning, is at your fingertips now, that you can use for content-based filtering. But the problem with content-based approach is, as I said, it's domain-specific. So you cannot suggest aspirin based on books. Okay? So somebody has to sit down and write things in some feature form. Okay? Now, interestingly, for text documents, you think the words are the lowest level features. Okay, at least that is there for you. For music, it's not even obvious. In fact, you know, for the music, in fact, the lowest level features would be Fourier transform coefficient, you know, or something like that. Okay, and it's very low level. Just as for text, words are extremely low level features. In fact, it's much better if you talk about features such as the Westerns, the nonfiction books, or you know, the historic romances, things like that. None of these are words. They are actually high-level features about books. If you classify your books in terms of those features, you can learn much better predictors. Okay. So again, in general, just as Pandora had to come up with reasonable features for the music that they're trying to, you know, send to, that they're trying to recommend to you, anybody who's doing content-based filtering has to come up with reasonable features for that particular domain. Okay, and of course, it cannot exploit the wisdom of crowds, because basically you have no connection to the rest of the users. You're only looking at your own world. Okay, so now how about combining both of them? As I mentioned, you can use content-based filtering to fill up the missing values of the collaborative filtering approach. Okay, and the interesting thing is, if everybody has 100% of the items rated, then every pair of users have 100% of the items co-rated. That's by definition, right? Okay, so what I'll do is, I will start with a user ratings vector, a particular user's rating vectors, and the dark green, whatever that thing, those are the items they have already rated, the others they haven't yet rated. Now, based on the ones they have rated, I will learn a content-based predictor. Okay, maybe naive Bayes classifier. And then using that naive Bayes classifier, I'll go ahead and rate the ones that haven't yet been rated. So these are, if you remain true to your original preferences, you would have liked these at this level. Obviously, they're not certain true ratings, but they are predicted ratings. So now I have a user vector which is actually full. And then the co-rating problem would be gone now. And cold start problem also will be gone. Most of the problems I talked about would be gone with respect to this. Except these ratings are bogus ratings to some extent. So the question is, if I start with this, will I do better in terms of accuracy of recommendation than collaborative filtering without this? Okay? And the answer is actually yes, you do better. Okay? So predicted ratings, as long as those ratings are predicted based on your past history, okay, are better than just ignoring what you might be saying here. Okay, so this works basically. So combining content-based and collaborative filtering this way works better than either. That's kind of nice. Yes. What do you mean? No, the presumably to learn, first of all, remember that this content-based filter, this is a pretty costly thing to do though. You are learning a content-based filter to use for each user first, okay? And if you were able to learn a content-based filter, it will give you some probability. So your question of what if these two movies have nothing in common is like asking in the old restaurant scenario, what if this new restaurant that this guy is going to has nothing in common to any of the restaurants he has gone to? As long as there is a reasonable set of training examples, you will be able to have some things common, some features common, and you will be able to use that in the naive-Bayes classifier to compute the probability that you would like versus probability that you won't like. And you will pick the one, the probability that you like is higher, then you will assume that your rating is higher. Okay? So that's basically the content boosted collaborative filtering. And this was actually an idea that these guys say in that paper. Where did they go? Oh, I went off my head. These guys say in this paper that they tried it, but it didn't work as well as this other idea. Okay, so I'm just saying this upfront. But, for a textbook, for an introductory course level, it's useful to know that this is a useful idea that you can use. Okay, now the last thing I want to say here before moving on to advertisements is there is a certain level of circularity here. I didn't have content-based, why am I not directly using content-based filter? I'm actually using, the interesting question that you have here is when you do this, then every user has predicted rating to every item. Then why do collaborative filtering? Presumably somehow, the ratings that you predict using collaborative filtering are better than the rating that you have predicted to this item based on your content-based filter. This is a mind-numbing thing. So the idea is there are 100 items. Okay, I'm trying to figure out whether or not I would like item number 57. I can learn a content-based filtering based on the items I liked, and I come up with a rating for 57, which is, let's say, 6. That's my best guess. Now, by doing this, what I'm doing is not only am I doing this to myself, I'm also doing, everybody is doing this content-based filtering and filling up their vectors. And then I'm using them to re-predict what I should be liking, how much I would be liking this particular item. 57, which by content-based filtering I liked about 6, might be predicted as I would like it about 4.5. And what the results, empirical results are saying is that would actually be better because content-based filtering has its own problems, just as, there may be not enough features in common and you're jumping to conclusions. Okay, so there is some sort of circularity as if you bootstrapped yourself, content-based was used to bootstrap the collaborative filtering. So the last thing is why not do this, without even having collaborative filtering. So go back to text classification, just simple text classification. And we talked about the fact that most of the problem is that in learning is the number of labeled samples. Okay, suppose I'm doing spam versus non-spam, and I'm basically for like these many documents have already been pre-labeled as spam versus non-spam. Okay, obviously. If a learning algorithm that does well with fewer examples is better than the one that does well with much many more examples, because the other one requires a lot more training data. Okay, so my question in this case is, suppose apart from these many, so if I'm here, I have 50 training examples. Okay, and this guy is actually just using those 50 training examples. And its performance on the test data is whatever the percentage here. My question is, suppose I also give you, for both of them, I give them another 10,000 unlabeled documents. This is basically, in the math example, these are the 50 worked out problems and 10,000 problems which haven't been worked out, but they're there. The question is, could you use the problems that haven't been solved to improve your performance? And the answer in this case, as you can see, is that in fact it is possible. This is a learner which uses the unlabeled examples, and with 50 training examples, 50 solved examples, it still was able to reach a much higher accuracy. Notice that as the number of solved examples keeps increasing, clearly they will both sort of reach the same level. Okay? But this is beautiful, right? I mean, this is sort of exactly how human learning works. That's why you not only have answers to the odd problems in the textbook, but you also have even problems. Why not just have odd problems? Because those are the ones with the answers. The even problems, you try them out, and you don't know whether the answer is correct or not. And yet, the very act of doing them, you learn something. Right? Okay? So, can classification learners do that? And, here is a technique that I'll tell you how to do it. It's very simple. So, I have, originally, 500 or 50 examples. I learn, and I always have a whole mass of unlabeled examples sitting. Okay? So, 10,000 unlabeled examples sitting. Okay? So, I learn a naive Bayes classifier on the set of trained examples, labeled examples. On the set of labeled examples. I got it now. Now, I apply that to the other unlabeled examples. Then I will know their class information, if my learning was correct. I'll go ahead and assume my learning is correct. So now I have answers to 10,000 plus 50 examples. I relearn the naive Bayes classifier on these 10,000 plus 50 examples. And then keep doing this until my performance on the training data is not changing, on the test data is not changing. Okay? If I do that, that's exactly what you're doing in your math book. I mean, you do a few problems for which the answers are given, and then you start doing a few problems for which answers are not given. And, as basically you're doing the ones for which answers are not given based on what you learned from the ones for which answers are given. Okay, so that's exactly what you're doing here. It turns out this idea actually works in practice. The only difference, the one thing that you have to do is remember that when you compute the naive Bayes classifier, so suppose you have a C and not C, suppose this is two classes, C and not C, okay, and you are computing probability that a training example belongs to C and probability that the training example doesn't belong to C. And then you are just basically assuming, if this is bigger than this, you will say example E corresponds to class C. That's how you are going to label the unlabeled example. However, suppose this is 0.51 and this is 0.49. You're not really that sure of your labeling. The ones that people gave, they know for sure what their labels are. The one that you are guessing, you are not for sure that the labels are, definitely class C. So instead, what I would like to say is this example is 0.51 of class C and 0.49 of class minus C, class negative C. So remember, in the whole naive Bayes classification, you are counting the number of examples in a class. Previously, an example would either be in the class or not in the class. So it has 1 and 0 as the weights. Now, an example can be 0.51 in this class and 0.49 in this class. So it gives a weight of 0.51 to one class, 0.49 to another class. So you keep track of the posterior distribution of the naive Bayes classifier and use that to figure out the fractional membership of each item, each unlabeled example in different classes. And so then, the next level, you essentially use these fractional membership numbers to compute the new naive Bayes classifier. And keep doing this until your performance doesn't change. And this is the first idea that you got in this class, essentially, of the idea of semi-supervised learning. Where here, you have supervised learning is the part where you have examples which have labels. And the examples which don't have labels are not supposed to help you. I mean, that's not trained, that's not labeled examples. Web is full of mails. Okay, only some of them are known to be spam versus non-spam. Many of them are just mails. You don't know whether they're spam or non-spam. So I can always give you unlabeled examples, and if you have the ability to improve your performance by using the unlabeled examples, you can be better than somebody who can't. Okay? Now the interesting question that you want to think about is exactly why does this work from an intuitive sense. I mean, in fact, there is a theoretical way of explaining this, which is essentially this turns out to be an idea called expectation maximization algorithm. And if you do an AI course and an ML course, you will learn about this. Okay? But the more interesting question for us is can we actually give an intuitive explanation as to why unlabeled examples help? And to understand that, suppose I have made up in the math book, right? There are 5 problems which have answers, and then I gave you 10,000 problems. I just made them up. They're just random strings of words. And you don't even, when you read this problem, you don't know whether it has an answer or not. Is it a well-formed problem, etc. Giving those kinds of gobbledygook is not going to help you improve your performance. Do you see what I'm saying? In fact, the hardest part is coming up with the problem, not solving it for you. Okay, if I can come up with the problem, then I can also solve it. If you define coming up with the problem as coming up with the problem which has an answer, then I can also solve it. If you say, Rao, come up with some problems, whether or not there are answers, I can write a large number of them. And I can give you all of those, and you will waste your time and won't learn anything. Okay? So even though you think unlabeled examples are useless, they're still examples. They do have the same structure as good math problems. That's why you are able to do this and bootstrap yourself. You're not getting something out of nothing. You're getting something out of partial information. Somebody spent a lot of time making these examples. Okay? In the case of mails, these are real mails that people got sent. They're just unlabeled. If you are, you know, since I'm telling you, I can use unlabeled mails, you might be saying, okay, here are true mails that some user said spam versus non-spam. Here are 80,000 randomly generated documents where I just randomly generated them. Picked, you know, words randomly from the vocabulary, made a document. And that's a bag of words. Can you improve your performance that way? No. Because they're not mails. They were not generated by anybody who actually was sending mails. Okay? So that's the thing you tend to miss when you think in terms of unlabeled examples. Unlabeled examples don't always have to help. They will help exactly when they were taken from the same distribution as the labeled examples. Okay? So that's a pretty, you know, deep point actually as far as some of the topics in this course are concerned. This is like, you know, a little above some of the other things we talked about. Okay? So I hope you understand that. So I'll stop talking about recommendation systems now and go for the next 15 minutes and probably part of next class to computational advertisement. Okay. So we are still in recommendation systems, except, you know, we are thinking of advertisements where, you know, Google is recommending that you click on this link whenever you're searching for something, right? Except when Amazon recommends that you might be interested in this book, presumably they are only trying to improve their own bottom line. When Google, by selling that book to you, when Google is recommending this, it's like they're acting as a publisher of advertisements. New York Times is not selling everything that it's advertising. Although more recently, actually, New York Times is not getting enough advertisements, so half the time they just advertise themselves in the paper saying, we are such a great paper, please buy us. And so if I haven't bought it, I wouldn't know that. But anyway, so mostly, normally they're supposed to make money by advertising Macy's and all these other people. Do you understand what I'm saying, right? So the question, so we'll talk, and you know that advertisements are like a huge deal. Everybody on the internet makes money based on advertisements, right? So we want to understand some things about it. Once again, just as everything else, you can do an entire course on this, okay? And I'll just do it in one class, hopefully. I mean, 15 minutes now and something next time. Okay. So here's the history of web advertising. In the beginning, they were just doing banner advertisements, which is sort of like, you know, print advertisements, where you just put it there, and you know, if you like it or not like it, they will put it there. Even if you are not in the mood for buying clothes, you know, the next page is Macy's advertisement. So, you know, you have it there. And if not enough people are interested in buying clothes, there's no point in, you know, doing a Macy's advertisement. And if, for example, the economy is in the dumps, there is no point in making full page advertisement for Rolex watches, because there are not enough people likely to buy it. Right? But that's the only thing you know. You don't know much about the user, and so you cannot actually direct the advertisements to the context that the user is looking at them. Okay? So in the beginning, you know, that's what they were doing. This is how print advertisement works most of the time. And, you know, that's what, you know, the web advertisement also tried to do. In fact, they also had even totally dumber ideas than this. I told you that InfoSeek, the search engine, would show the 10 results and say, if you pay us $10, we'll show you the next 10,000 results. Okay, so I'm not making this up. This was the idea they had of making money by doing, you know, buying, selling stuff. But anyway, in this case, the display advertisement was there before, and the other idea that came about when, you know, apparently in 2000, but it looks as if it's been much longer in my view, is there used to be the search engine which would essentially say, who the heck cares about, you know, users? Why should we do nice things to users? We will just sell the first page positions directly to the advertisers. So if you, you know, if you say White House, and Herman Cain really likes White House, so he'll pay, you know, $1 million, so he will put, you know, the Overture would put Herman Cain number one as the White House result, okay? Number two would be whoever else who pays the next. And this would be the search result. So there would just be one window, first Herman Cain, then somebody else, and somebody else, and somewhere below, maybe in the 15th page is Obama with his real White House. But, you know, he didn't pay enough, and so he didn't show up in the result. Okay, so that's what Overture was doing, and it was actually working fine to the extent, apparently there are people, I don't know who these people are, but apparently there are people who go to web and search for shoes. They'll say shoes as the keyword. I mean, obviously I'm not one of them, so I don't know how these people work, but so if you're doing things like that, shoes, then, you know, there are tons and tons of people selling shoes, and you know, Overture would say, you want to go first, you know, Nike, you want to go first as the shoes guy, you know, you pay us like, you know, $10 million, we'll put you first. That's what they were doing, okay? And the one big difference with respect to the print ad was, in the case of print ad, once Macy's pays the money, and also television ad, okay, once Macy's pays the money to New York Times and makes this full page ad, even if all of us, none of us looked at that ad, they already paid New York Times the money. Do you see what I'm saying? They don't basically have any sure way of making sure that people are forced to look at it. So in fact, they had to come up with all sorts of interesting ideas. How do you make people look at things? How many of you still read magazines? And if you open a magazine, sometimes things fall through it, and then you have to bend and pick it up. The guy who invented that became a billionaire. You see what I'm saying? It's like, just basically make people pick it up, and then you have to see for a 3 second period, three millisecond period. That's a great idea, because, you know, most of the time we are not looking at the ads. And so you just have to make sure that somehow, you know, things will happen. I know sometimes Macy's will put some scent there, and if you like the smell of that scent, you might kind of look at it more. And, you know, they might put all sorts of things to just keep you looking at that ad. But they have to do it beforehand, and they have no guarantees. New York Times is not giving any guarantees to Macy that people will actually look at this ad. Okay, so in this case, actually, there's an instant way of seeing whether or not people are looking at the ad, because if they click on it, that's one more step towards looking at the ad. So Cain lists himself as the number one White House guy. You click on it, and then he will talk about his manifesto. You might, you know, say, to heck with it, I don't want to read it, and go out. But at least you went to his page. So then essentially, in that case, Cain will pay money to Overture only when people click on it and go there. And the money would be, the contract would be how much money they pay per click. Not how many votes, you know, Overture will get for these guys, because that's not guaranteed. Okay? So it's still better than print ads, clearly, right? The interesting thing is, this is pretty much the, when this came around the 2000 time, 1998 is when Google paper was written. And if you remember, you all read the Google paper. Do you remember the dripping righteousness in that paper about how bad people do advertisements and pure search in the word pure in capital P, and no, none of us will do any kind of advertisements, and you know, it's sort of bad, and that's why we're doing it in academia. You know, around that time, you know, Overture was doing this, and so Google gets to look down on them, and then after a while, the people said, if you want to go IPO, you actually need some money, you know, to make, right? Not just righteousness. And so they said, okay, we will be still good guys, but we'll do what we said we won't do. You know, and essentially the difference, the only difference was they separated the ads. The major innovation, quote unquote, was in the Overture, all the results will be one column, and it will be clear which ones are sponsored, which ones are not sponsored, but it will be one column. And here the Google basically said, these are the non-sponsored results and the, what they call organic results. They were homegrown apparently. And then these are sponsored results, right? And so, and then of course, the good thing about this actually is that you can buy things like AdBlock, which will just put a big white banner here so that you don't have to see them ever. Okay, but you know, remember that if you know enough to actually get the ad block and put it on your browser, then you are in like 1% or 2% of the world population. You know, most of the world population doesn't know that if the computer comes with Internet Explorer in it, with Bing as the default search, they can change it. They don't know that. So you need Justice Department and you need antitrust people to stop Microsoft from bundling internet. Do you understand what I'm saying? So don't, you know, you people, I still hope that you're all computer science people, and much of you, the biggest problem that you will have is understanding people who are not computer background people. Okay? You would think, what's the big deal? You know, I mean, what's the huge deal about changing the search engine that you're using? You know, it's a whole click, okay? But obviously, huge number of people don't know that. Okay, and when you feel particularly smug about it, remember that that's exactly what biologists will be thinking when you are completely clueless about the diseases you are suffering from, and you don't know whether you can take antibiotic to kill a viral disease or not. And they'll be thinking, what's the big deal? How clueless can these computer science people be? So the point is expertise, and you are, you know, experts in computer science, such as it is, and you know, and you know how to get rid of this, right? That's okay, how to, you know, do some of these things. But anyway, so you show these advertisements here, and you show these results here, and then apparently once in a while, if you feel like, some people will click on this. And if you when you click on this, then Google gets money from the advertiser. That's the thing. That's how it works right now. Clearly, it's a huge business right now. Most of the money Google makes is from this. Everything else, they lose money. They don't mind because they make tons and tons of money on this. Economy was totally in the dumps in the last quarter, and Google had spectacular results in their quarterly results, because people are still selling stuff on these small advertisements. Okay, there's some advantages. There's some advantages for this, because anybody now can set the advertisement. One of the interesting things here. There are multiple things that change here. First of all, even by the time you came to Overture, you don't need to do like full page Macy's kinds of ads. You might be saying, for a particular query, I want to be shown. So Ken doesn't need to, so Ken basically wants to say he's a viable candidate to New York Times readers. He has to buy like a whole entire page in New York Times. Okay, and people who could care less about politics are still getting that page. And so he's paying for all those views, okay, whether they actually look at it or not. Here, in the even the Overture model, in the Overture model, the advertisers are bidding on the keywords. So Kane says, show me only if people are looking for White House. And do not show my page anywhere if people are looking for things like sexual harassment. It's not good stuff. Okay, so basically you are paying for the keywords that you want to be shown for. Okay, and so first of all, users get to pick what they want to be shown for. The advertisers get to pick what they want to be shown for. And the users will not have to see advertisements that are not connected to what they are interested in. At least if you are searching for White House, you get shown White House page, probably you won't mind. Not too much at any rate, right? So essentially that's a big deal in terms of Google versus Overture. The only difference is Google puts them separated from the normal search results, okay? So there is this advantage that you're bidding on the keywords. And then the other thing is that there are minimum rates for buying advertisements on print media. And that's pretty costly, okay? Whereas here, any of us can buy advertisements. Actually, in fact, I think I was looking at this course on internet advertisement, and where the instructors basically put an advertisement for IR, you know, internet advertisement class, please join as advertisement. So anybody looks at internet advertisement, their advertisement comes saying, please come and join our class. And you know, professors don't get paid much money, and there is no point in, you know, I'm not going to be able to take a New York Times, you know, full page ad saying, please come to my class, otherwise it'll get canceled. Okay, so but what they were doing is they were putting $1 per day is their budget limit. And they are basically willing to pay maybe 10 cents maximum per click. Okay, so anybody gets shown this advertisement and they click on it and go to the class homepage, they'll pay them, they pay Google 10 cents. Actually, there's a little change there that we'll get to later, but you know, they are willing to pay up to 10 cents. And for a whole day, they're not going to pay more than $1. These budgets are important, by the way, because in fact, you know, as I said, once we are talking about advertisements on the internet, internet is adversarial, so the best way, I don't want their class to get too many students compared to my class. What I will do is early in the morning, I wake up and keep clicking on their ad, right? Until their entire budget gets over. In fact, hopefully they'll get bankrupt, in which case, you know, that's, you can do that. I'm not, you know, it's not just that, it's not an academic rivalry. In fact, competitors do it all the time. And so, in fact, apart from all the other adversarial problems on the web, this is one more adversarial problem on the web. You know, other competitors will try to click on your ads and make click-throughs happen so that you will actually, they're hurting you where it really counts, which is your advertising budget. Okay, but at the same time, I can make an advertisement campaign even with a little amount of money. Just a little amount of money I can put up, you know. And I can pick any arbitrary kind of advertisement. You know, like there's very, very few times, you know, people will be selling, you know, certain kinds of esoteric items by taking full page advertisements in New York Times, right? Whereas here you can have both general advertisements and special advertisements and everything in the same place, and then when people are looking for that special thing, they get that advertisement. In fact, that's likely to be clicked. Okay? So not surprisingly, performance-based advertisement actually works. Here, performance is that you clicked on the ad and went to the page. You didn't necessarily have to buy it. You at least took first step towards buying it. Okay? In fact, even after you buy it, you still didn't give the money to the company, because you may buy it and send it back because you didn't like it. Okay, there's this whole funnel for advertisers. You know, they're hoping that first they'll actually, you go into the shop. Second, you don't run out of the shop because it smells bad. So at least they'll put some candles, etc. So you'll wait for a few seconds. Then third, they hope you'll buy something. And fourth, they hope that you don't return it next day. Fifth, they hope that you like the one that you bought so much that you'll keep coming back to the shop. That's the big funnel advertisers are trying to do, right? But this is the first step, coming into the shop. Coming into your internet shop, which is your web page, is the first step. And you only pay when people come in. That's basically the deal, right? So it's a multi-billion dollar industry, and there is very interesting problems, and I just basically am going to end with this, but come back again to this next class. The interesting thing about this problem is there are three parties, and they have completely different utility models. There is a search engine who is actually trying to feed you the advertisements, because if you click on those advertisements, they get money. There are advertisers who are trying to sell advertisements, not because they want to give money to Google, but because they think that if they give 10 cents to Google, then the return of people coming into their store and buying stuff is much more. So they are maximizing that profit. And there is you who mostly hate advertisements and won't mind seeing good advertisements once in a while. And you will get really, really mad if I show you totally nonsensical advertisements like, you know, about Viagra and, you know, interesting pictures all over the place as soon as you go to a page, because your boss might not like it. You know, it's bad enough that you're searching stuff in the work hours, but they also have pretty pictures being shown as advertisements. They won't like it, right? So users are sort of, you know, interested in the relevance of the advertisements. Search engines particularly don't care about relevance. They just care about whether user clicks on them. Since users won't click on irrelevant advertisements, they're trying to show relevant advertisements. And advertisers just want to sell their stuff. It doesn't really matter whether you really want it or not, but if you buy it, I'm very happy. So the question is, can I make the advertisement at the time you are likely to buy it? And the interesting question is, there are different utility models for all of them, and building a good computational advertisement system has to somehow balance these conflicting and utilities of these people. Okay? In particular, we'll come back and notice that some of these utilities are synergistic. You know, maybe the search engine as well as advertisers both want more clicks. Because advertisers want more clicks because people will buy stuff from them if they get into the store. Search engines want more clicks because they get more money. Search engines and users want good ads because, you know, they share in their interest in good ads. Okay? But they can also have conflicting utilities, because search engines, for example, would like to pay a lot more per click. But search engine advertisers want to pay much less per click. Then the question then becomes, there are multiple advertisers. And if you are going to pay $10 per click, 10 cents per click, that guy is going to pay 11 cents per click, that guy is going to pay 13 cents per click. The search engine not only has to figure out what are the relevant advertisements to show for this query, but among them, who is going to pay more? And furthermore, if the guy who is paying 11 cents is selling a crappy product, and you have seen that the last million times you showed their advertisement thinking you will make 11 cents, nobody clicked on it. So you're not getting any money. Whereas the guy who is only paying 3 cents, actually people tend to go to their page. So what matters is not how much I'm bidding, but how likely are people likely to click on it. And the search engine is interested in that too. So it's an interesting complex problem, and what we'll spend next class, or at least a part of next class, is how to balance these conflicting criteria.